right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show, towards the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by members of Outer National talking about their new CD, Todos Somos Ilegales, and their tour through the Southwest with all that. Looking forward to, they haven't been here for a while, looking forward to talk about it. The CD itself is a killer CD. You really need to check that out, and you'll hear more about that as we go along. But the first two-thirds of the show is going to focus up around the L.A. Rebellion. That's right, a rebellion. Not a riot, not mindless violence, but a rebellion. In fact, the largest urban rebellion in the history of the U.S. 20 years ago, on April 29th, 1992, L.A. erupted in rebellion. And think back, those of you who were alive then, or conscious, or just watching the news then. Think about what you saw. The major news anchors in the country sat tight-lipped and nervous while walls of fire raged on the screens behind them. Remember that? I mean, I remember sitting in D.C. and looking and saying, whoa, looking at Ted Koppel sitting there with a big, big screen and just nothing but flames and buildings burning behind him and thinking, wow, something very, very significant, very important is going on out in L.A. And people were shown, well, they sat tight-lipped and nervous, well, all those newscasters sat tight-lipped and nervous. People were shown dancing in the light of the flames, venting their anger, fighting the police whenever and wherever they could, wherever they encountered them. And at some, and, you know, basically people were moving with pride, and their eyes shined with a mixture of rage and a ferocious joy, a joy that was rooted in the idea that it's right to rebel. You know, it's right to rebel against injustice. And that's something that I think is really being fought out in the press, in the atmosphere today. Was the LA Rebellion actually just a riot, just mindless mob violence, or was it a righteous rebellion that was indeed right for the people to stand up and rebel against injustice? And I come down very solidly, as you would guess, on its right to rebel against injustice. So joining us to talk about this today is going to be Carl Dix, who's a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, who's a journalist and writer in L.A., and longtime journalist and writer in L.A. She was actually doing that. She was covering L.A. At the time of the rebellion. And a little bit later in the show, we'll be joined by Georgiana Williams. Georgiana is one of the, she's from the Florence and Normandy corner, and she is the mother of Damian Williams, one of the L.A. Four, who was basically scapegoated, targeted by the system to serve as a warning to the people who rebelled that what can happen to you. He was threatened with many, 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 many dozens of years in jail for what happened to Florence and Normandy. Now, for those of you who don't know what Florence and Normandy is and what its significance is in the history of the L.A. Rebellion or in the course of the L.A. Rebellion, Florence and Normandy is a corner that became famous for the fairly brutal beatings of a number of motorists. And Reginald Denny was the most severely beaten. He was a white truck driver who happened to drive through the intersection. His truck was stopped. He was pulled out of his truck, and he was beaten very severely. And four young black men were arrested after a sweeping campaign into the neighborhood, collective punishment of the neighborhood. They were rounded up and arrested, and they were put on trial and faced many, many decades of prison, basically as a message being sent from the system to the people, to the black people, about if you stand up and rebel, we will crush you. That was all concentrated at Florence and Normandy. So first off, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Yeah. So, you know, you were here when the rebellion happened, you know, and as I said in my intro, there's now, 20 years later, a real attempt to sort of cut this down, to sort of change the idea of what it was, to sort of present it as, at best, a tragedy that shouldn't be repeated, or at worst, mindless mob violence that was used by opportunists who did anything they could to sort of get for self. You know, you were here in L.A. at the time, at the outbreak of the rebellion. For people who don't remember, or for people who weren't even born yet or conscious yet, can you tell them what your take on the rebellion was? And why you call it a rebellion?
Yes, it definitely was a rebellion. I come down on the same side that you do on that question. And look, I was traveling to L.A. to speak at that point. I happened to be there when the trial of the four cops who were caught on videotape brutally beating Rodney King, hitting him 50 sometimes with their billy clubs, kicking him and all that kind of stuff. And myself, like a whole lot of people in L.A., we're like, okay, this happens to black people all the time, but this time it's caught on videotape, so they're going to have to give up some justice. And I'm sitting there watching the verdict being read in court, you know, and I'm ready to write down the verdict. And then I realized I didn't have to write anything down because they found all of the cops not guilty on all of the charges. and it was like they had just slapped black people in the face. We don't care if you caught it on videotape. This is what we do to you, and you have to like it. So just shut up and take it. And it was very heartening to me that people did not just roll over and take it, because that would have meant that this system and all the brutality that it's brought down on black people, other oppressed people in the centuries of its existence, had succeeded in defeating black people and beating them down so far that they would take anything from this system. So it was very important to me that people stood up and said, no, we're not going to take this in silence. And the fact that black people were joined by Latinos, whites, and others who were against injustice to say that this was unacceptable and that there was a nationwide response. To me, that was very heartening and very important.
You know, it says something, too, when you think about it. This rebellion was actually also met from the very beginning. I mean, while there was a temporary pullback of the police as they rushed to guard the sort of centers of power and money and all that other stuff, and they pulled out of neighborhoods and oftentimes were chased out of neighborhoods, at the same time, very quickly, this became the largest domestic military occupation in the U.S. since the 1960s. I mean, they brought in all kinds of federal troops, National Guard, police from everywhere. It was just amazing the kind of mobilization that came in. And yet still, for 3 days, people continued to rebel. The ferocity of the rebellion, you know, continued on. Let's bring Aaron in. Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. Aaron's the author of Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line. And she's covered black issues as a journalist for 20 years in L.A. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me. I have to correct you on one thing. In 92, I was not quite yet a journalist. It actually is what got me into journalism. I was kind of a slacker at the time, and I was looking for kind of a vocation, and I was writing for a very small publication at the time called Accent LA, but it was the events of 92 that actually briefly expanded the consciousness of the LA Times, and I was brought in as a reporter, and that's how I really got started. But anyway.
Well, although I have a hard time imagining you as a slacker, okay?
I didn't really have a full-time job, so I wanted to do something significant in the community. I wanted to write. Those things had not quite come together, and they did come together that year.
All right, well, let's talk about this a little bit. What is your sense of when people talk about, was this just mindless violence or was it a rebellion? What was your sense of what happened on that day?
Well, I think it was absolutely a rebellion. I rebelled. I jumped up out of a chair myself. I hate to admit this. I was getting a facial at a salon, okay, at that afternoon. I really did not think there was a need to follow the verdict. I just assumed the verdict would be guilty, at least in some way. I was so surprised that I had to do something, and I was born and raised in South Central. I mean, I've lived in the community. I know that sense of the cops are with black folk. But we really, like Carl said, we really felt this time there had to be some justice dispensed. There wasn't. So anyway, I and a friend of mine said we got to do something. I went down to First AME to attend what I heard was a rally. Never made it to that rally. But the point is, I felt, like you said, Michael, at the beginning, pretty energized. I'd never seen people in the streets in L.A. my whole life. And it was kind of exciting to see people, this kind of widespread action. It was, I felt it really was something very significant. And in terms of the, what's called rioting, and I mean, look, there was a lot of looting. There were some people, out there taking stuff. But to me, that was an effect of a rebellion. It wasn't the reason why people were out. And I'll just say that I think we missed the point of the whole thing, at least in the media, because it was immediately characterized as a riot, as a law and order problem. The deepest people got was, well, maybe there's a problem with law enforcement and the criminal justice system. But in terms of the economic problems, the really deep-seated issues that have been around since 65 and well before that, those were never addressed. And so we're essentially in the same place now, probably in a worse place because of the much bigger recession we're in now versus the one in the 90s. So, that's what I think of the whole thing.
All right. Well, Carl, let's go to this. What do you think about the point about the roots of the rebellion itself?
Well, the spark to the rebellion was clearly the criminal justice system and the brutality and the discrimination that it targeted black people with. That's what sparked this off. But I think Aaron is right that some of the forms it took, including the shopping that people went on, was a reflection of economic deprivation that went along with that brutality, because in fact some of that brutality's point was to enforce the conditions that black people and other oppressed people are kept under in this society. Another thing that needs to be looked at in relation to this was the gang truce movement, because one of the things that tore at my heart and still does to a large degree is this thing of oppressed people fighting each other. And that was something that L.A. was known for. But what came out of this rebellion was a gang truce movement and people rising above the thing of, well, I'm down with this set and you're down with that set, which makes you my enemy, to, no, we got a common enemy. And I remember talking to a lot of youth, including youth who weren't at all involved in the gangs, but who said, this gives me hope. I've seen people who were lifelong enemies because they were Crips or Bloods and fighting each other, and if they can get out of that and get together, then maybe we can get together and fight the system. And that was an important thing about it, because one of the things that we set ourselves to, we in the Revolutionary Communist Party set ourselves to in that period, was not only uniting with and defending the rebellion, but working to help people move from rebellion to revolution, because Aaron is also right that we are still under the same and, in fact, intensifying conditions. Because when you look at it, the prison population has doubled. The targeting of blacks and Latinos by the criminal justice system has intensified. In fact, I characterize the current situation as a slow genocide against blacks and Latinos that could easily become a fast one. And that is a reflection of the system having remained in effect and come back at the masses of people and, you know, tightened up the stuff that they do to us.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, an L.A.-based journalist and the author of Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line. And we're talking about the L.A. Rebellion. This is the 20th anniversary of the L.A. Rebellion, and we're digging into that and trying to present a truthful portrait of what happened and why it was significant. Now, Aaron, one of the things that you've written about, you spoke a little to the point that you were raising about some of the roots of the rebellion. And one of the things I thought that Carl mentioned a little earlier, too, was, and I think it's important to kind of dig in a little bit more, is, you know, there was one of the things that happened, and I think this is where some of the ferocity of the rebellion came out, is that it really was, as you both have indicated, people were, they expected this. They had immense expectations that this time, if never before in history, this time we would get something. The system might work because everybody saw it. We had gone through Latasha Harlins killed by the Korean grocer and it was on video and nothing happened. And we had gone through all this other stuff. But now this time, you know, the stuff that the police do every day as just normal functioning, this time it was on video. No one could say it didn't happen. Nothing they did could hide the actual character of this. And yet it did. And don't you think that had something to do about this? When those verdicts came down, you know, I remember a guy in the Nickerson's telling me, when the verdict came down, it was like somebody took a shotgun and shot him in the stomach and a big hole opened up and there wasn't any blood, but his entire life force was just whoosh out of him. And he felt completely robbed of life and humanity. And those expectations being dashed had a tremendous impact, I think, on people psychically.
For sure, for sure. One thing I say, I read a column about this for the LA Times, which is coming out Sunday. You know, you're right, 92 versus 1965, it was 27 years later. We were in, at the start, I think, of a, you know, new media age, right? So everybody saw everything in real time. We had CNN, we had, you know, people could see this literally in real time, and over, there was instant analysis, people on the ground, you know. So we felt like, okay, everybody literally sees this. There's a filter, but, I mean, it was just obvious to everyone that this was wrong. You know, you couldn't dispute it, you couldn't spin it, et cetera. And so when the verdict came out, it's like what Carl said, the message was, it doesn't matter that it's wrong. It doesn't matter that the cops were wrong. We still find them not guilty, meaning we saw what we saw, but it doesn't matter. And so, of course, for black people, that Rodney King is, you know, we didn't we didn't say the phrase at the time, but we were all Rodney King. We were all being beaten. That was all of us on the ground being beaten and being told, you know, you are not worth it. You are not worth the justice. And that's why you got this collective action, because we're still in that space, you know, black for black people. This all matters. You know, as much as people tell us, we're all of us individuals and our fate is our own, blah, blah. This happens to all of us, you know. And so that, to me, was what accounted for the tremendous reaction. And like I said, I just kind of amazing in a city like L.A. where it's very hard to get people in the streets for any reason. And so that to me was a measure of how, like you said, humiliated and frustrated people were, because we felt, well, gosh, if it's not happening this time, it's never going to happen. You know, and I know that the struggle is long and, you know, and it's never over, but my God, this was a complete rejection of any sort of, you know, justice or just even an admission that something had gone wrong and we need some restitution. It didn't happen, and people felt that this it was just too much to take. And it was very personal, like you mentioned. It was very personal. People felt it personally. I mean, it was a very political thing, of course, but like you said, it was like a punch in the gut for all of us.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking today with Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, an L.A.-based journalist and the author of Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line. And we're talking about the L.A. Rebellion. This is the 20th anniversary of the L.A. Rebellion, and we're digging into that. It's really significant when you dig into this thing where it's people are actually saying this stuff about, well, there's been a whole section, there's been a whole time where basically, this country and its history and its basis, built on slavery and the continuing suppression, the hundreds of years of living in a white supremacist society. And when people stood up, this was it really took a tremendous amount of courage, and just suddenly the sky cracked open and people could get a glimpse of what was actually going on in the society. And I thought that was really important. And it's interesting because now this kind of thing is being turned around. And both of you have referred to this in your comments. But one of the things I think that we really have to draw a link between, and I think in a lot of ways people spontaneously see some of it, but we have Trayvon Martin just murdered and all the terrible stuff that's been going on around that. We have Oscar Grant, we have Manuel Jimenez, we have, you know, Sean Bell, we have people all over the place that this continual savagery towards black people. And Aaron, you described this once at one point as you talked about making the link yourself. You said that black people still today, they're being profiled just as Rodney King was profiled. There's an assumed criminality. People are suspects and perps. And Carl, you talked about it in relation to what's going on today. So Carl, let's hear from you first in terms of what's the relationship between 1992 and 2012?
Well, there's a very clear and sharp relationship, and you see it in the response to the vigilante murder of Trayvon Martin. I mean, there was a very visceral outpouring from black youth who saw themselves as Trayvon Martin, from black parents who saw their children could have been Trayvon Martin. And it's a recognition that this happens all the time and has been happening all the time. But this case became a point where this time we have to get something. And it was very important that people, you know, because now they're telling people, get out of the streets and let the system work. And I tell people, well, wait a minute, the system had already worked when they let that killer out. That's the system working. That's the way it's worked all the doggone time. And what was necessary was to take to the streets to make it unwork and force an arrest in this case, but also necessary to stay in the streets if there's going to be any chance at justice. So that's the thing that I think ties it together, because, look, things have escalated from the point, like Aaron was talking about. I mean, there was a time when they exploited black people as the bottom tier of the workforce in the factories. Before that, it was as sharecroppers on the plantations. Before that, it was as slaves. Today, they don't have a way to profitably exploit millions of these black youth, and prison has become the place to put them, not just for money, but for social control. This is the way we're going to control a section of people that we got no future for. And I call this a slow genocide that could become a fast one. That requires a mass response. So to me, it was very heartening again to see people step out around Trayvon, and they need to keep stepping. They can't sit back and let the system work, because the system has worked the way it works for centuries now, and there has been no justice for black people in its working.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, author of Black Talk, Blue Thoughts, and Walking the Color Line, and an L.A.-based journalist for 20 years. Aaron, what do you think about what Carl was just saying?
I think that's true. I was thinking as he was talking that, in fact, we've had a problem with blacks in labor, black people working since the end of slavery, because I think some folks at the time in 1865 or thereabouts said, well, you know, really there was no idea of where black people were going to be in society. There was, again, there was really no use for them or desire to have them work. And I think that that's still true now. I think that the work, you know, many of us are working, but the fundamental kind of sentiment of really don't want them working, I just think is still around. And so you'd never hear discussions about kind of the moral problem of black unemployment. I mean, it's been depression. We've been in a depression for as long as I can remember. You know, black unemployment and underemployment has been at least double that of whites and the highest of any group. And, of course, the recession has gone crazy. One thing I say in the column that comes out Sunday is between 2006 and 2011, which is when the current recession, you know, really got underway, unemployment in L.A. Black unemployment went from, you know, and this is a conservative estimate, 8.3% to 20%. And of that number, you know, it's like 65% of black men between 16 and 24 are not working, and it's higher for women. So this is a crisis. It's been a crisis for, as Carl says, generations, but the lack of response to it, the continued lack of response and continued indifference to it, can only mean that we don't consider it a problem. It's sort of normal. This is just how it is. Black folk are just sort of out there doing nothing. And what are we going to do with them? Prison is certainly, in some scary way, logical. It's where they go, and it's where they do some quote-unquote work, and it's the best place for them in the minds of a lot of folk. So, and that has really exploded, you know, in the last 20 years since 92. And so that's, you know, so we have yet another crisis. But I think a lot of people simply don't see that as a crisis. They don't see the prison crisis as a crisis. They see it as, you know, works pretty well.
Well, let me ask both of you this. You know, part of the thing is Aaron, you said back in a recent article, revisiting the L.A. Rebellion, you made a point that at the time, and as you said earlier in this interview, you made a point that you were mostly excited by it, and you expected something major to come out of it, that a big tide was turning. And both of you have indicated that, in fact, that's not what happened. But one of the things that comes up a lot, I think, is for a lot of people is, okay, well, if you're saying it was right to rebel against injustice, but what kind of change? What did it accomplish? Carl, what do you think it accomplished?
Well, one thing it accomplished was making very clear that black people had not been broken by this system. And that's an important thing, because black people have long been on the cutting edge of the fight against injustice in this country. I mean, when you look at the 1960s, it was actually the stirrings of black people that got things started. So that was a very important part of what it changed and what it indicated, what it pointed to. There was the gang truce movement that I mentioned before, you know, and that was very important, because it was a thing of people getting out of what the system had got them into that kept them down, and striving to come together to fight against it. But then the other thing it points to is that short of revolution, you can't end all of this stuff. Because as long as the handful of people who monopolize wealth and power in this society have that monopoly, and through that control the use of force in this society, they're going to keep hundreds of millions of people in this country, to say nothing of billions of people around the world, down so that their system can keep on robbing them.
Aaron?
I would agree with Carl that what, you know, rebellion showed was that black people are very resilient, you know, very, and in some ways optimistic, despite despite having no real reason to be optimistic, and really believing in, I mean, the fact we believed in change and didn't get it speaks to that optimism. But I have to say, I feel, and maybe I'm speaking kind of, you know, naively as because I really did thought something, I felt something would change, and it didn't. But so I learned a lot of things in my 20 years as a journalist covering community. But Black people themselves, I think, sort of took the eye off the prize or off the ball. Just like in 65, there was a whole, you know, there were some jobs that were created after that, but not jobs on for the masses, sort of jobs in, you know, some civic organizations and some, you know, kind of government leadership positions. I mean, people sort of became like this post, quote-unquote, post-riot business, RLA and stuff like that. And I think that Black people just didn't keep agitating. And I don't know why I keep expecting the middle class to agitate. They just don't. But I feel like the leadership class, whoever that is, the public figures, simply did not follow up, did not keep alive the basic grievances that sparked the rebellion. Because I think, and in fact, I think now they still, Black people, the leadership class still struggles with what to even call this. How do we commemorate it? What do we remember? And I heard a bunch of people talking about this on the radio, and I, you know, of course, a lot of the Black bureaucrats didn't say anything. They just said, well, you know, change takes a long time, and, you know, we're all getting along better, and they just, it was very, very soft focus, and I don't know why I expected more, but I feel like that kind of symbolized how we as Black people, in a way, don't know what to do with our own issues, and I think that is the most disappointing thing for me as a journalist. The thing that strikes me is in the 20 years I've been talking to, you know, these folks, people will say to me, well, you know, I really believe in change and revolution, da da, and then they'll say, but you can't quote me on that. And in public, they just don't express that. And so that's been the most frustrating thing for me, is this disconnect that happens in that group of folk who, for better or for worse, that's who we go to, that's who we look to, as a kind of a temperature gauge for change.
Okay, we're going to have to wrap this up here because we're running out of time. Carl, Aaron, thank you both very much for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking about the L.A. Rebellion on the 20th anniversary of the L.A. Rebellion. We've been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and L.A.-based journalist Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. We're going to take a quick break and come back to talk with Georgiana Williams, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. And that is Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy, and the song is Nighttime is the Right Time. And just a little backstory on that, that album was recorded on May 1st, 1992, and the front cover of that CD is one of the major boulevards in Los Angeles burning with fire during the L.A. Rebellion. And this was Nighttime is the Right Time, but was a Lester's way of commenting on the L.A. Rebellion. Joining us now to talk about the L.A. Rebellion and what's changed and what hasn't, especially around Florence and Normandy, is Georgiana Williams. Georgiana is a community activist. She's lived in the Florence and Normandy area. She was living there when the rebellion began. And her son, Damien, was one of the people that the system targeted to try and make them pay a price as a warning to Black people and others throughout the city and throughout the country. If you stand up and rebel, we will bury you under the prison. Georgiana,
welcome to the show.
Good morning, thank you.
Sure. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Pretty excited about all this. Let's jump into this. We have a limited amount of time, but I wanted to talk with you a little bit about, people are talking about all this stuff of, well, things have changed. And I know when I talked to you the other day, you were saying, I beg to differ. Let's talk about Florence and Normandy 1992, Florence and Normandy 2012. What's changed?
I see very little changes. Our kids are still dropping out of school. Our kids that are going to school still don't have books and don't get homework. Our brothers and sisters in the community still don't have jobs. They still got a whole bunch of liquor stores and oriental business and they're not giving our brothers and sisters no job. They're locking them all up. The Spanish-speaking people, the African-Americans, and the brothers and sisters from other islands, they're filling up the jails and they're filling up the prisons.
What about the role of the police there? Because I remember when the rebellion first popped off, there was something that happened to Florence and Normandy that the system tried to bury, which was right in the neighborhood.
They said Damien started the rebellion. But we know better, because I know I had friends that told me they were down in the Parker Center as soon as they got the verdict, and they were down there burning paper and everything else. And people told me they were at Central Avenue and Imperial Highway. There were people at Wilmington Avenue. There were people everywhere burning. So I don't know why they think he started the rebellion. I think maybe because I spoke out, because what I saw was wrong. I grew up in the South. I remember Emmett Till. I remember Medgar Evers. I remember you, the Lord, when I got out here. And I wasn't about to let that happen to those four young men who live right there in the same neighborhood. Antoine Miller lived with me. Gary Williams lived at the service station. Keith Washington lived on 69th Street. When I got home from the beauty shop, there were thousands and thousands of people over there. I couldn't even get in my own parking lot. So how could they say Damien did all that? Superman can't move around that fast.
Yeah, and the other thing actually, though, is that also was always left out of the story is that as soon as the verdicts came down, the police came into Florence and Normandy and into the neighborhood there, into your neighborhood, and immediately began harassing people and jumping on them and doing all kinds of things.
Right, they sure did, because the boy across the street was about 14 or 15, and he was coming down the street. Now, this is what I was told, because I was at the beauty shop, that he was coming down the street and he had a rock and a bottle. And about eight police was chasing him. He hopped the fence. Someone got his mother. Someone got my son, Mark. And the police was beating Sean down with their billy club. His mama, my son, Mark, and other people was trying to get them off of them. My son, Mark, was arrested. Kermit was arrested. Kermit was just standing on the corner. He said he wasn't doing anything. They don't even talk about that trial. They were acquitted of all the charges. They don't talk about the Mark and Sean Dale's mother's chest, where they beat her with that wood stick they carried. They don't talk about any of that. They don't talk about how they came over and harassed the young men. Even after the four young men was arrested, they was over there every day. We did not have no peace. They would come over there at night and put the bright lights on my house. They even had the nerve to put an immigration bus in front of my house, because they know that people next door to me didn't have papers. And they know that I had said, if they come over there and try to arrest them, I was going to tell them, hop the fence and get into the church, and they can't go in there.
All right. Good for you. Good for everybody, actually, that there's people like you out there doing that. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking now with Georgiana Williams. Georgiana is the mother of Damien Williams. And Damien was one of the four young black men, put on trial and accused of beating the truck driver Reginald Denny at the corner of Florence and Normandy, what the system has tried to say constituted and characterized the entire rebellion. And they put these young men on trial in order to deliver a message to the black people of Los Angeles for standing up, saying that if you stand up, we will crush you. And while the system tried to get that message across, the jury in that trial didn't buy it, and the LA4 were acquitted of most of the charges they faced. Now, Georgiana, tell me something. What do you see when you talked about, okay, that generally things are still arresting people, still doing this, what about the police in the neighborhood today?
Okay, you know I moved from over there.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Damien was getting out the first time, I was at a Catholic church over on Crenshaw, and this lady walked up to me. Ms. Williams, don't turn around. You don't know me, but I know you. And I know that your son is getting out of prison. So it would be good if you could get out the neighborhood, because 77th Street is planning on putting him right back. Damien got out. He was out 3 days, went back to my house to get some more clothes, and they arrested him. And he was downtown 3 months. I hired up two private investigators to go there and investigate, and gave it to the parole office. She didn't even give it to the hearing office. So my son said, will you please get my mother? And I went and said, I don't know what you can do. I said, well, I had two probation officers to go over there and some investigators to go there, and they got a different report. Did you read it? And he said, no, where is it? So I said, I gave it to the lady, pointed to his parole officer. He read it, what they said, and everything was dismissed. And Damien was back home. So, you know, they just constantly have asked. They was always over there, like, the kids would wake me up. You know, I work night. Georgiana, Georgiana, the police. I said, what's wrong, officer? And they would tell me someone had called and said that someone had jumped the fence with a gun. You know, I didn't believe in all that stuff. They were out there every day. Every day and every night, they were out there. That's why I moved.
Georgiana, we have about a minute left, and I wanted to ask you this, and that is, one of the big things that they keep running out in the L.A. Times and everywhere else is the idea that now we have a kinder, gentler LAPD, and they're treating the people in the neighborhoods much differently. They're no longer an oppressor. They're a community partner. What do you have to say to that?
That's the biggest lie ever told. So if you think the police are so sweet, come over there and see.
All right, Georgiana, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. God bless.
All right, Georgiana, thank you very much. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with Georgiana Williams. Georgiana is the mother of Damian Williams, who was one of the four young black men who was jailed and put on trial for the beating of white truck driver Reginald Denny in the opening hours of the L.A. Rebellion. And Georgiana was talking with us about how things really have not changed since 1992, except to get worse. We're going to take a quick break, and actually we're going to take a kind of unique break here, because what we'll do here is I want to let you listen to a song. And this song is from Outer National, and this is our next guest. We're going to be members of Outer National, and we're going to be listening to a song from their new album, Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. And the song we have playing here now, I want you to listen to an extended clip of this. The song is called The Beginning Is Here. And when we come back, we'll be talking with members of the band Outer National. So check this out. Outer National with the song is The Beginning Is Here from their new CD, Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. And joining us to talk about that is Miles Soleil, who is the frontman for the band. Miles, welcome to the show.
How's it going? Glad to be here.
Yeah, welcome back, man. It's been a while, but listeners might remember that Outer National played in, about 2 or 3 years ago, that you played, you did a live performance here in the studio, and it was, people just loved it. But the band has developed tremendously since then in its sound and its makeup and its whole conception of what it's doing. Can you tell people a little bit about this album, for instance?
The We Are All Illegals album, actually, the inception came because the last track on it is a song called Que Queremos. And the chorus of that song is Que Tenemos Nada, Que Queremos Todo el Mundo. What do we have? Nothing. What do we have? What do we want? The whole world. And that was the first song that our band ever wrote years ago out in New York City. And then when the SB 1070 law was passed in Arizona, we got involved in the boycott and going out there and the resistance to that really unjust and odious law. And we wanted to kind of use a record, our debut full albums, so to speak, to use it as a launch pad and a springboard to kind of help people imagine a world where no human being was illegal and people weren't actually carved out and separated and all these just unjust, you know, divisions that we see in the world today. So we kind of use this record as sort of a cinema way of expressing that.
Explain that when you say a cinema way.
Well, the album has Todos Somos Ilegales has 12 songs that we wrote and recorded, featuring a bunch of, you know, we also have a lot of special guests on the record. But then we weaved it together. There's actually a tremendous amount of good films that have been made over the years about Mexico and the border. From people might be familiar with El Norte. There's also Sin Nombre and Rob Rodriguez's Machete, and Tommy Lee Jones made The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada. We even sampled Bob Avakian's Revolution speech from a few years back, a film about Juarez, Mexico called Backyard. And so we used the dialogue from these films that we then scored to sort of weave it together as if our album was a film. So it was actually, creatively, it was very exciting to create. And it's a very linear record, as if you were crossing the border.
Now tell me something, because you've been on tour for what, about a month now?
Mm.
And you've been going through the Southwest and the West, and you're sort of in the cradle of a lot of this, you know, where a lot of this really reactionary stuff is going on against immigrants. And you come up with an album that's We're All Illegals, you know, and actually the front, it's actually titled with Todos Somos Ilegales being the lead phrase in the title. And with the translation following. But then you've been taking this album out and the content of it, as you're saying, the cinematic concept, the presentation of the concept in a cinematic way, but the power of the music itself. What's the response been on the tour?
Man, the response to our band, you know, has been tremendous. I think people are first pretty taken aback in a positive way about a band of revolutionaries from New York City traipsing about the Southwest. You know, we launched the tour down in McAllen, Texas, and in Brownsville, Texas. This is in the Rio Grande Valley, South Texas. They're tremendously populated areas. They're not small towns, although there are many small towns there, but they're places that bands don't traditionally go. They're just on the other side of, for example, Brownsville's on the other side of Matamoros, which for many, many years were big crossing points for people crossing up the border to get into the United States. And so I think even from the first word, people are like, who are these guys and what are they talking about? And so the response has been tremendous. I should say that I was hoping that we were going to have some kind of wild and woolly shows, like maybe some Blues Brothers, like, you know, Good Old Boys. Like, I was hoping we were also going to play some places in Texas where people would, like, you know, want to know if we play country and Western. But on this tour, the word has really gotten out. And so we've just had sort of tremendous response. And each day has been different. It's not like every night in a regular rock and roll club. Sometimes we've been in community centers. We've been in clubs. We did one show at the Tohono O'odham Reservation in southern Arizona. There's an indigenous reservation. It's the second largest reservation in the United States. And the border runs right through their reservation. So there's a lot of complex issues there. And we were given a tour. So it's actually been a tremendous experience. And it's the best thing our band has done to date.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Miles Soleil, who's from the band Outer National. And we're talking about their new CD, Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. Now, Miles, can you tell us a little bit about the special guests you have on there?
Yeah, there's a lot of special guests on this record. I'll start from the end. We did one of the films. It's a film called The Border. And there was a great song written by Rye Cooter that was sung by Freddie Fender of Texas Tornadoes fame and all that. And we covered the song called Across the Borderline. And we did it in a really tremendous way. We sampled Bob Avakian, the great revolutionary leader. He sang a cappella in his infamous revolution speech from a few years ago. And we sampled that and then recorded the music ourselves at Daptone Studios in Brooklyn. So we have Across the Borderline featuring Bob Avakian. We also have Deportees, the Woody Guthrie song that we do with Tom Morello, the Night Watchman. The single on the record is called We Are All Illegals, and it's Outer National. It's produced by Tom Russo, and it features Calle 13, features Chad Smith on drums from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Morello also has a guitar solo on there. We have a song called Canta El Rio, which is a song, it was actually a real collaboration with Ceci Bastida, who used to be in Tijuana.
Tijuana.
We're actually playing tonight. Is our first ever show in Mexico. It's very exciting.
Oh, cool.
We're playing Tijuana tonight, and Ceci's going to come up, and it's going to be the live debut of that song.
It'll be a homecoming for Ceci then.
Yeah.
There you go. I remember her cover of her voice and the keyboards on Spanish Bombs.
That's right.
That cover of The Clash, just incredible. Well, let's let people listen to the single from the CD, We Are All Illegals. So, Teddy, why don't we go on to, I'm guessing actually this is track 4. Welcome back. That is We Are All Illegals featuring Tom Morello and who else?
Chad Smith.
Ah!
Red Hot Chili Peppers, yeah. Rene Perez, the rapper singer from the great Puerto Rican band Calle 13.
Tremendous band, actually. I really like them. I told you once before, I met their father, right?
Jerry Medina, the trumpet player. Yeah. Bad dude.
Oh, amazing trumpet player, man. When he plays that horn, it just wraps around your heart, it wraps around your spinal column, and it just takes you out somewhere else, man. It's just that horn and him.
It gets really high. It's very impressive a lot of the great salsa trumpet players. But when they hit those high notes, it's piercing.
Yeah, exactly. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Miles Soleil, who's from the band Outer National. And we're talking about their new CD, Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals. Well, let's talk a little bit more. There's something else here that you've been talking about. And the tone of your CD, of all the work you guys do, it's a very revolutionary band.
Mm.
You know, and I think, and it's not, which isn't a matter of standing up and shouting slogans, but you do songs that really kind of twist people's head, you know, it makes them actually, it's sort of like getting a jolt of electricity on their brain, just kind of, whoa, what did he say here? You know, and there's a lot of these songs, First Among Equals, Ladies of the Night, all these songs, you know, you have a lot that actually tells that forces people to confront things, but in a way that takes them up out of the muck and the grime and makes them see things in a bigger way. This is amazing stuff that you're doing with this band.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I think on this record, it's true. We tried to do two things artistically, is you have the songs that stand on their own. But then we really did try to make it a cohesive piece, which I think we succeeded in doing. And I appreciate you mentioning some of those songs. For example, Ladies of the Night is this, people are well familiar with El Paso, Texas, the other side of it, Juarez, Mexico. And, you know, there's been a tremendous atrocity going on in this city for 15, 20 years now. The feminicidios, all these women who've been disappeared. And we wrote a song called Ladies of the Night about that. And it was kind of a surrealistic portrait of what if all of these women who, in reality, the most horrid things have happened to them. But we tried to imagine, if all these 10,000 women and little girls who've been disappeared, what if they actually, what's happened to them, hadn't happened to them, but they're actually just out in the desert, kind of on this big spirit dance, conjuring up, you know, revolutionary dreams of a whole other way the world could be. And for me, that was kind of exciting to write. Also, there's songs like We Are All Illegals and Fighting Song, which are real powerful statement songs and very exciting. But to me, it was also kind of artistically a new opportunity, a new opening to do songs like Ladies of the Night, because man, you can go places in a song that you can't, maybe you can't ever go in real life, or at least we can't go yet. And that's some of what we were trying to experiment with, paint some different pictures of the tremendous, you know, like you see all these, for example, all these women and all these little girls and all these Mexican people who are symbolic on this record of immigrants and people all over the world who have this tremendous potential as human beings, as little children, and you see how that all gets crushed down. And we tried to say, wait a second, what if that wasn't all crushed down? What if that was actually given full flight? And that's some of the revolutionary stuff that I guess you're speaking of that we tried to bring to the record.
Yeah, and it does it in a way that is poetic and visceral at the same time, that really just takes it there. I want people, we're running down on our time, but I want people to get a chance to hear one more song before we go out with the one that you were just talking about, Across the Borderline, because we're going to go out with that one. I think it's a really beautiful version of that song with the, as you said, featuring Avakian and you know, and the kind of that medley there is just really, really beautiful and powerful. But I want people to get a sense of one more thing in terms of what we were just talking about. There's a track, Teddy, let's do track 8. It's called Buried and Done. I'm being really mean and just teasing you with what you'll get when you get this CD. Miles, let's talk about this. We were just talking about this. Tell people what Buried and Done is about. And you said that it was a hard one to write. Why?
Well, I'm glad that you played that song. That was a pleasant surprise. Buried and Done, you know, it was written before the murder of Trayvon Martin. It was written last year, but in a lot of ways, it's about Trayvon Martin and all the young brothers and sisters like Trayvon. You know, in the first verse, you know, just trying to kind of imagine a mother who's too afraid to let her son, who really is a teenager and should be able to go anywhere he wants, but she's sort of afraid to let him walk anywhere because, you know what, maybe he's 6'2", he's got a shaved head, maybe he's got tattoos, and he's just a threat to some racist police pig officer in the street who might just murder him down. Why was this song difficult to write? Man, that's what I'm always asking myself when a song is difficult. You know, sometimes a song... Nah, man, okay. Some songs, you know, I wrote a song called Ladies of the Night. I don't even really play guitar. And I just picked up a guitar and wrote that song. It was almost like that. Buried and Done, I knew what it was about. I had it all, you know, once we decided what it was. And yet, you know, it takes a couple weeks. That's just, you know, things. I once read a thing about Toni Morrison, the great author. And she said she wakes up every morning and writes... because what if she gets inspiration when she's not writing? So that's one of the things we really tried to do in 2011 when we were writing this record along with another record, Welcome to the Revolution. We're just trying to write. You're a writer, Michael, you know. Sometimes you got to write so that your pen's hitting the pad when that comes.
And a lot of times you just get those words just stuck at the end of your fingertips.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
Sort of like, oh, that's it. And you got to get it out. Well, you've done a remarkable job on this album. And again, the album is Todos Somos Ilegales, We Are All Illegals.
Let me just say something else really quick while we're here. I was listening to the rest of your program. I just wanted to say for all your listeners who may not be aware, as a young teenager getting involved in revolutionary politics and getting exposed, you're two pieces on the LA Rebellion. Shockwaves and then Aftershocks. People don't know, maybe you can find it online or at Revolution Books, but really seminal and very important works that Michael did, for the people now listening, did really in-depth pieces interviewing folks in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it was really important at the time and even more so now. Miles, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
That's right. And thank you for, and anyone who wants the record, you can just search it on outernational.bandcamp.com.
Okay. All right, well, that wraps up another show, but before we go, there's something I wanted to read from Bob Avakian, you know, because this being around the time of May Day and the whole history of that struggle and that holiday, and the idea that actually internationally, the people of the world internationally, humanity internationally, the working class internationally, but the people of the world actually need to stand together, especially on a day like May Day, May 1st, an international revolutionary holiday. And this is a day when we really need to consider, first and foremost, the whole world
comes before any individual country and any individual grouping of people.
We've got a whole future of humanity to be looking out for. So I wanted to read a quote from Bob Avakian that kind of captures the spirit of this and leave you something to chew on over the next week. All right, so here it is. And again, this is from Bob Avakian in the book Basics. If you can conceive of a world without America, without everything America stands for and everything it does in the world, then you've already taken great strides and begun to get at least a glimpse of a whole new world. If you can envision a world without any imperialism, exploitation, oppression, and the whole philosophy that rationalizes it, a world without division into classes or even different nations and all the narrow-minded, selfish, outmoded ideas that uphold this, if you can envision all this, then you have the basis for proletarian internationalism. And once you have raised your sights to all this, how could you not feel compelled to take an active part in the world historic struggle to realize it? Why would you want to lower your sights to anything less? Again, that's from Bob Avakian and the book Basics. And it's in honor of Revolutionary May Day. I want to thank all of my guests today, Aaron Aubrey Kaplan, Carl Dixon, Georgiana Williams, and Miles, and the other members of Outer Nationals, some of whom are sitting out in the lobby, jumping up and down, I would hope. I want to thank my board op for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Now, I'm going to go out now with one of the songs from Outer Nationals' album, Todos Somos Ilegales, and it's a song that Miles was talking about during our interview. It's a song that features the vocals of Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and Miles Soleil from the band Outer National. And the song is Across the Borderline. Check it out.
There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find. And when you reach the broken promised land, every dream slips through your hand, and you'll know it's too late to change your mind. 'Cause you paid the price to come this far, just to wind up where you are, and you're still just across the border.